Greetings and welcome to the 200th episode of Rebel Spirit Radio. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and for this episode, it's just going to be me. I thought that I would take the opportunity of the 200th episode to reflect on where the podcast has been, where it is, and where it may go in the future. And I do have some important announcements about the future of the podcast. So for my longtime listeners or viewers, please stay tuned for that. The first thing, though, I wanted to do is thank all of you. I want to thank my audience of Rebel Spirits. I couldn't do this without you, and I'm doing it for you. So for all of you who have subscribed to the YouTube channel or follow the podcast, thank you. From the bottom of my heart, thank you. I also want to make special note of my patrons over at patreon.com/rebelspirit. There aren't that many of you, but those who do make monthly donations, words can't even express the depth of my gratitude. I am so very, very thankful for all of you. So what I want to do, and I'm doing this really unscripted. I've got a page of notes here that are just kind of scribbles, and I'm probably not going to edit this, so I will apologize in advance for my verbal pauses and the ums and the uhs. I try to be mindful of them, but I know I can get carried away. Once early on in my teaching career, I had a student stay after class and said to me, "You know, you're a great professor. I love the class, but if I hear you say one more time, my head's going to explode." Ever since then, I've tried to be mindful of it, but I still get carried away. As well as starting sentences with "and." So there's often just this ongoing sentence where I'm like, and I'm trying to be mindful of that as well, but with probably not that much success, to be honest. I wanted to also talk a little bit about me, why I started the channel in the first place, although I think I may save that to a little bit later. What I really wanted to do for this episode was reflect on some of the common themes that have shown up in the podcast. Maybe mention a few of my favorite episodes and guests. And then move forward. I also want to acknowledge some of the guests that I have had on who have since passed away, but I'm going to wait a little bit for that too. So I guess I'll actually start with why I started the podcast. Changing. It's going to be wild. It's going to be a free for all. And I may change what I wanted to say, the orders. I was working on my doctoral dissertation. And I think many of you know my educational background. I actually began in journalism, and I spent about 4.5 years writing for a family-owned newspaper in Manitou Springs in Colorado. It was a wonderful job. Manitou Springs is an amazing little village. It's only about 2,000 people, but it was an incredible experience. And I had a shared editorial writing award. The editor and the owner at that time of the newspaper was John Graham. So we had that shared award. I realized early on, though, that I did not want to spend the rest of my life as a journalist. I was out of school, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't have a name for it, to be honest. I was doing a lot of reading, and I was reading a lot of classic books, a lot of literature. You know, I went through the works of Kafka and Dostoevsky. But I also started exploring some of the more traditional spiritual texts like the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, books on Buddhism. I was very lucky. My best friend was a psych major in college, and she really opened up my love of Carl Jung. I was vaguely familiar with Jung. I took a psychology class in high school. We did not go into any kind of serious detail about Jung, but I had this interest in Jung. And so I read Man and His Symbols. I also was very interested in Joseph Campbell. I have to thank my aunt for that introduction. And so I had this interest in spirituality and understanding religion and the history of religions. I just didn't know that there was such a thing as religious studies. So I ended up leaving the newspaper. I quit my job. I sold everything I owned and I left the country. I did this bike trek with a friend of mine. We flew into Rome and initially headed south in Italy, then went inland a little bit and then went back up to Rome, kind of followed the coast for a while, then went inland to Siena, traveled up Route 222, at least it was at that time, also known as the Chianti Highway, to Florence, made our way to Pisa. Pisa was awful. I did not like Pisa at all. Ended up getting on a train because my friend got hit by a car. He was fine, but he was like, you know, let's just take a little bit of a break. Got back on the bikes, rode up into the French Riviera, and then inland into France for a while. I know we went to Avignon. I think we got a little bit north of Avignon. But one of my life's regrets was that we went through Paris in the middle of the night on a train. Made it to Calais and then took the ferry over to Dover. Ended up in London for about a month, maybe 3 weeks, a month. I don't remember. And then I ended up in Denver. And that's how I ended up in Denver in the first place. About a year after showing up here, I got myself into school. I went to Metropolitan State College at the time. It is now Metropolitan State University. And I majored in philosophy. It was the closest I could get to what I was really looking for. When I was in community college in Colorado Springs, I had taken a mythology course because of my interest in Joseph Campbell. And it was horrible. It was dry. It was boring. It was not at all what I wanted. So I was looking in the course schedule for the upcoming spring semester, and I saw a class listed, Myth and Symbol. And I thought, okay, I'm going to try this again. So I went into the course, and this was with Dr. Sharon Kogan, who has been a guest on the podcast a couple of times. I've maintained contact with Sharon over the years. The first half of the class was all about Jung and Jungian theory. And then the second half of the class was applying Jungian theory to the Olympic deities of Greece, of classical Greece. And it was everything I was looking for. I was so excited for that class. So I signed up for another course with her in the fall. That one was Differing Concepts of God. And I remember having a dream when I was in this class. And in the dream, I was standing in front of this pond, and there's no such pond on the campus. And I was watching in the distance a UFO. I observed it. It was coming closer, and then it dove down into this pond. Next thing I know, I am in the pond, full scuba gear. And I see this ring of lights, of golden lights, coming towards me. And that's the craft. It's now just this golden ring of light. And I reached out my hand and I touched it. And then I woke up. And I always told everyone that I woke up from that dream feeling like someone had whacked me upside the head with a 2x4. Because I knew, I finally knew at age 27, 28, I think, what I wanted to do. I was always the kind of person where I could tell you what I didn't want to do, but I could never tell you exactly what it was that I did want to do. But I finally had a name for it, religious studies. I think I took 7 or 8 courses with Sharon as I completed my undergraduate degree. Did my graduate degree at the University of Denver. As part of that program, towards the very end, I also participated in an international service learning program in Nepal. life-changing, absolutely life-changing. And it really cemented my love of the Asian spiritual traditions, especially Buddhism. And it was in Nepal that first time that I remember I was at Bodhnath, which is this Buddhist stupa. And it's one of the largest Buddhist stupas in South Asia. And it's very crowded. A lot of pilgrims, a lot of Buddhists, a lot of tourists. But I went into this, I guess I would call it, I'll call it a shrine room. There was one Buddhist monk standing there, kind of welcomed me in, and I was the only person there. And in front of me was this massive gold Buddha. I remember thinking, you know, I accept the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. There's a cause to suffering. There's an end to suffering. And here's how you end it, right? It's the very short version. But it's a moral vision, but it also is a metaphysical vision in the sense of how the world operates, that everything is impermanent. It's ocean waves, just ocean waves. I remember standing there thinking, well, why not? You know, First Noble Truth, it's true. You can't deny there is suffering, right? Later on, a day or two later, my friend Natalie, who was there, just announced to the group, Nick and I are Buddhists now. And I thought, okay, why not? So I identified for a long time as a Buddhist. I would often say I was a bad Buddhist because I don't have a Sangha. I don't meditate as regularly as I should. But I do try to put myself in alignment with a lot of Buddhist ideas. And that idea of impermanence is one that I also know to be true. And I don't want to go into a lot of details in this video about my spirituality. I have thought about doing an entire video on my spiritual journey. So for example, when I did that bike trek through Italy and France and made my way to London, I had a copy of Joseph Campbell's Hero with 1,000 Faces and Carlos Castaneda's Journey to Exelon with me. And it was kind of a spiritual journey for me. But there's a lot more. If you would like to know more about my spiritual journey, I'm happy to create a video with that. So just make comment. Comment on that in the comment section on the video, and I will put something together. But anyway, I had a name for what I wanted to do, which was religious studies. And I was just driven. I was driven that I wanted to get my doctorate and that this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to teach religious studies. So I graduated with my master's in religious studies. It took me a little while. I worked full time. I worked full time throughout my entire college education. I worked at the University of Denver for 10 years while I was doing my undergraduate degree. And as I was also going through my graduate program, I started a joint program between the University of Denver and the Iliff School of Theology. It was Religion and Social Change. The program was started by Dr. Vincent Harding, who was a friend of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. There was definitely a focus on social justice. I was going to, weirdly enough, we kind of hobbled together, my advisor at the time, Dr. Jenny Ishimatsu, we hobbled together a kind of a program and experts that I could work with, and I was going to focus on religion and politics in South Asia. Because the university had hired me as the site director for the project in Nepal. However, the political situation in Nepal kind of deteriorated. I did take a group of students in 2003 in a unofficial capacity, but the program got canceled, and which was unfortunate because I would have been able to go every year and then, you know, maybe stay for a few weeks after the program and do research, but it just didn't work out. And then I ended up losing my job at the university, which was one of those major moments in life. I was always involved in the community, in the campus. I had a good reputation, always had outstanding evaluations. That September, I was laid off in March, so just 6 months before, I had received an award for outstanding contribution to the university and the surrounding community. So I was one of five people in the department that I worked in that got laid off due to a budget crisis. And I will just say bad management as well. But when I lost my job, I lost my tuition waiver. I freaked out about money and ended up in California. I worked the worst job I ever had. I was at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. I didn't work for the university. I worked at the university for a vendor, especially in their IT, online learning. Worst job I ever had. I would just drive into work and I would just sit in the parking garage and just sob. I had a friend from my hometown who lived in California, and she taught at a community college, and she told me, she was like, it's easy to get a job. So I kind of followed her advice, and sure enough, I was able to get a teaching job, and I started teaching, but this was part-time. 70% of college professors in the United States are part-time faculty. We are adjuncts, contingent. Very little in the way of job security and next to nothing in terms of benefits. But I loved it. I loved teaching. I did. I absolutely loved it. Now, I woke up to a different reality several years later, but I loved teaching. And the students liked me. I got incredible evaluations also from my peers who would sit in on my classes. I did end up finding a doctoral program. I tried to get into University California Riverside. They had just started a PhD in religious studies, did not get accepted. I was told later, my friend Natalie ended up doing her master's degree there. She said, you were probably better off, not because of the program, but because of the person I was trying to work with. So I looked around and I found the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. I remember at the time I was looking into consciousness studies. I was very interested in that. And they have a program at CIIS, Philosophy, Cosmology, and Consciousness. And I looked at the faculty. I'm like, this is where I want to be. It's a private institution. It's fully accredited. And there are some really smart people that go there. And some of the faculty are amazing. In retrospect, I don't know that I should have done it because I now am faced with massive student loan debt and I never wanted to be this far into debt ever. And I had accrued debt while going through my undergraduate and graduate programs. I tried not to take out too much money, but it's the nature of the American educational system. It's a money-making machine. And given that 70% of college professors are part-time faculty, this idea that higher education is just a collection of a bunch of elitists is nonsense. Most college professors scramble to put together a living. And there have been a few who have died doing so. But, you know, I moved up to the Bay Area for a year. Ended up moving back to Southern California. Personal reasons, I took a leave of absence. I ended up completing the program, but I did it in a really wonky way. I would drive to Bakersfield and take Amtrak up to the Bay Area, sleep in youth hostels, and then go back and teach on the weekends. And it was pretty exhausting, I will admit. And it was detrimental. There were people that I wanted to take courses with that I couldn't take courses with. And I really didn't get to be a part of the community. The program I graduated from, PCC, really kind of prides itself on its ability to create a community. And it did. It did very well. We would have annual retreats to the Esalen Institute at Big Sur. And that was awesome in terms of community building. And I know some amazing people out of that program. I guess I'm trying to say I wish I knew them better. I did take a leave of absence. I did leave that program, like I said, and I initially had transferred out of PCC to their Asian and Comparative Studies program on the advice of an advisor who told me that and then was summarily fired, which was odd, but I did like the Asian and Comparative Studies program, especially with Dr. Stephen Goodman, who has since passed away, and Dr. Jim Ryan. There were some other amazing people there, Rena Sinkar. My advisor at DU knew both Stephen and Jim Ryan. She had gone to graduate school at Berkeley with Jim, and Stephen officiated her wedding. And Stephen was an amazing guy. Jim Ryan was good, too. But It just something felt off. That's when I took the leave of absence. And I went back into the program. I had to kind of fight to get back in. They had what was called an integral ecology track. And I had looked at that initially, but it didn't seem really fleshed out. But what happened was I was at Target one day, and this was in Pasadena. They have a two-story level Target. And it was during the oil explosion in the Gulf of Mexico, where every day we just kept seeing this oil just billowing into the ocean. And I remember I was at this Target, I was on the escalator kind of going down, and it just hit me that everything I was seeing, I was like, this is all petroleum, this is all oil. And these sorts of things are going to continue happening unless we start changing. So I asked to get back into PCC. The intention was to do the integral ecology track. Now, at this time, they also brought in another professor, Dr. Elizabeth Allison, who would eventually, she's still there, she would also start the ecology, I always get this wrong, ecology, spirituality, and religion program. She eventually told me that I'm an honorary member, although I've officially graduated from PCC. So Elizabeth ended up being my advisor, my dissertation advisor. I did my doctorate on environmental virtue ethics and the American political system. I was trying to identify core American virtues through our political system and through our religious history and demonstrate that these could also be environmental virtues. The dissertation process was brutal. It was absolutely brutal, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time complaining about it or naming names, but I will say that I ended up in the hospital at one point and also in therapy. The therapy helped quite a bit, but this is when I learned that I had a general anxiety disorder. Now, throughout this process, my goal had always been to get a full-time teaching job. And I don't want to spend a lot of time complaining about this, but I will mention it. The main school that I had taught at, and I was essentially their religious studies guy, was Pasadena City College. And they had 3 full-time openings in 3 years. And not once did they hire someone who had been teaching for them. And, you know, community college is not about research or publication. It's, in general, you're told that it is about excellence in instruction. It came down to one vote. And I'm pretty sure I know who was blocking me and who continued to block me. I was gutted when I didn't get that position. And it wasn't that I felt that it should have just been handed to me, but you know, I still believed in merit, that you do a good job, you will be able to advance in your career. But they got to the point, you know, and I remember being told, like, well, we have 2 more positions coming up, and I couldn't even get an interview. And it was just degrading and humiliating and disrespectful is how I felt. I mean, when I found out I didn't get that job, I cried every day for 2 weeks, and then every other day for another 2 weeks. And then I thought, well, you know, okay, I need to get the dissertation done and put all my focus on that. And I thought, okay, August 1, I'm going to start. And on July 29th, my mom collapsed. So in 1 year, I did not get the job that I really wanted. And then I lost both my parents. That was 2015, 10 years ago. Worst year of my life. So I took another leave of absence, you know, I just had to, you know, I had to deal with all of that. But I did eventually get to writing. And that was, you know, again, like I said, that was its own brutal process. But towards the end, there's a reason I'm mentioning all of this. Towards the end, I will often refer to it as a vision, but it's not like, you know, seeing archangels or anything. It was just this sort of gnosis of, oh, well, that's how it's done. You have a podcast, you have YouTube videos, and you write, and then you build your audience, and you can sell courses. That's how it's done. And that really was the birth of Rebel Spirit Radio. I was inspired by some content creators on YouTube, especially Dr. Justin Sledge of Esoterica. One day I will gird up my loins enough maybe to reach out to him to see if he would like to chat with me. Jackson Crawford, I think his YouTube channel is just under his name, but he does these amazing videos in set in Colorado on Norse religion, right? And I thought, well, you know, they do it, I can do it too. Because it became very clear to me that academia was closed off. I applied for job after job after job. One of the other schools that I taught at, I do want to say something good, East Los Angeles College, they always treated their faculty with respect. It's a smaller program than Pasadena, but the chair of the department told me, he's like, look, if we have a full-time position open, any adjunct that applies, we're automatically going to give you an interview. You know, you're clearly qualified because you've been teaching for us, and it's just the right thing to do. You know, it doesn't mean you're going to get the job, but at the very least, you get the interview. It demonstrates respect. And that's what I don't get. I mean, it's easy. You know, I mean, philosophers should understand this, especially since they focus on ethics, right? Some schools do, some schools don't. Anyway, that was sort of the origin of Rebel Spirit Radio. And I'll be honest, it was my planned escape route because I knew, I felt in my bones that there was something bad coming with academia. We got into, you know, I graduated officially in 2019 and then the pandemic hit, right? And, you know, I've taught online. I've been involved with online teaching since about 2000. So that was fine by me, but it was shortly after the pandemic ended that things started going south in academia in the sense that there is what is being referred to as an enrollment cliff or an enrollment crisis. There are just fewer students. I think it's a smaller generation of students. And it's also probably the case that some students just don't want to go into debt anymore. So there were fewer courses. And what that meant was that I got fewer courses. All the adjuncts got fewer courses. And it's also very, I will say it's very belittling to have spent a decade teaching and having outstanding evaluations, not being able to move into a full-time position where people from outside were brought in and they maintain full benefits, full job security, and then those of us who have been teaching there get nothing. So it got to the point where I had a really sweet deal. I was renting a house from an amazing Armenian family in Pasadena. The patriarch of the family had his sixth stroke. It was a big one. So the family had moved out to buy a bigger house. And after the family patriarch, Jerry, had his stroke, the family had to move back in. They had to sell their bigger house because they couldn't afford the medical payments, which I won't go into any kind of rants about the healthcare in this country at the moment, but I lost this sweet deal that I had on this amazing house. It's the longest I ever lived anywhere since the house I grew up in. So it was really sad to leave. I made the decision to moved back to Colorado from California. I was in California for almost 19 years. I'd been in a long-term relationship for 17. And there were issues. I did not want to necessarily leave my partner, but there were a lot of issues. And I held on to it. I tried. I'm like, look, I'm going back. This can be just temporary. But eventually it didn't work out. So I've been living in my best friend's basement in Denver. I taught online Pasadena and East Los Angeles for a while. I gave up Pasadena. I just had to do that for my own well-being. I did start teaching in a couple of schools in Colorado and Denver, at Regis University, which is a Jesuit university. And last year I started teaching at the Colorado School of Mines. All the students, it's one of the top engineering colleges or universities in the nation, and all their freshmen are required to take this class, Nature and Human Values, and it's a mix between an environmental ethics course and a writing class. Mines paid really well, and they always treated everyone with a lot of respect, incorporated the voices of those who were teaching for them part-time. I loved Regis. The students reminded me of my students at East Los Angeles, but Regis didn't pay that well. And I would only get classes at Regis in the fall, nothing in the spring. I initially had been offered two classes at Mines last fall. I said, I just, one, I'll do one. taught a shorter version of the class in the spring, but what's happening is that because there's a fear for funding, that the government's not going to be giving as much funding, especially the class that I was teaching, and they had, I think, like 14 people teaching it. What they did is they raised the cap, so the number of students, and so that meant that there were fewer sections. And so I knew that, you know, I'd probably be stuck with just one. So I've kind of watched my life savings vanish. Now, as all of this was unfolding, I've been plugging away at the podcast. And I've developed a really good relationship with some of the publishers, and the authors seem to enjoy talking to me, or at least so I've been told. I'll say a little bit more. I want to come back to the where the podcast is, but I do want to look at some common themes that have emerged in the podcast. One of the very first people that I interviewed was Dr. Krish Baish, and this was his book on LSD and the mind of the universe. And I had met Dr. Baish at Esalen one year. He would sometimes teach in the program I graduated from. Amazing guy, and I was so happy to speak to him. But one of the things that he learned in his experiences that he details in his book is that humanity's in an initiatory moment. And I think that's absolutely true. And this is something that kind of keeps coming up. And it's been expressed in different ways. A lot of my guests will say, well, we need to remember who we are. I always take that and put it into the context of a shamanic initiation. Because in shamanic initiations, the initiate often undergoes this symbolic dismemberment. Then what has to happen is the shaman has to remember themselves, right? Put themselves back together. I think that humanity is going through this process right now. And I think we're at the beginning of it. An error that I think a lot of people make is that they think that the process is going to be quick. I don't think the process is going to be quick. We are not anywhere near coming out the other end, I don't think. We're just at the beginning. Things are falling apart. And I think things are going to continue to fall apart out of necessity. Now, maybe individuals will come out the other side quicker than culture or the whole of humanity. I don't know. And honestly, I don't even know if humanity is going to make it through. But we are in this process, and this process is connected to the natural world. And I've often said in the podcast, it's that old hermetic dictum, you know, as above, so below, but it's also as within, so without. And so what we see happening outside of us is a representation. It's mirroring back to us the sickness and the dis-ease that is within the soul of humanity. And because of that, a lot of guests I've had on have talked about doing shadow work. And we definitely need to do a lot of shadow work. The shadow, of course, comes from Carl Jung. And it's this idea that the things that we don't like about ourselves, the things that society says that we can't express, we end up repressing. And that's what makes up the shadow, is all this stuff. And then the shadow will erupt. And it's this idea that, you know, you always see in others what you don't like in yourself. That's shadow. There's also this idea of an alchemical process, which is also an initiatory process that speaks to all of this, right? It speaks to this dismemberment. It's solve a caligua, dissolve and then re-bring together, right? And so this is something that has run through. And also this idea of healing, that humanity, we just need to heal. And we need to heal individually and we need to heal collectively. Spiritual traditions can help us with that. And so can, you know, psychology and different theories and whatnot. And so these are what I've been exploring. And of course, this idea of connecting to nature. I see our necessity of reconnecting to nature as inherently religious, because religion means, you know, religare is to rebind or reconnect. And often that's seen as, well, with who or what? Well, God, of course. I'm like, nature, the natural world. We need to remember, and again, we need to remember we are nature, right? There's no separation. So, no surprise, these are some things that have come up in the podcast over the previous 199 episodes. I do want to talk about or mention at least some of the guests that I've had on that I've particularly enjoyed. So, for example, Mitch Horowitz. I originally reached out to Mitch to see if he would be my guest for this episode, but he was just too busy and he couldn't do it. But Mitch is a really nice guy. He's a very nice guy, and he'll probably be back on the podcast. We'll see, depending on where the podcast goes. Peter Coyote. I love talking to Peter Coyote. He is the voice. He's also a Zen priest, and he's full of wisdom. That was a very enjoyable conversation for me. I fanboyed out with T. Susan Chang, who is a tarot master, tarot guru, I don't know. But I really enjoy Susan Chang and her work, and she does some phenomenal stuff. And I just, like I said, I fanboyed out a little bit on that one. I've had a couple conversations with Dr. Bernie Beitman about synchronicity, and I've really enjoyed those conversations. And Carl Abrahamson, I very much enjoyed getting to know Carl. I think he's been on the podcast three times now, maybe. Yeah, I think three times. But he's been good. And I'm not trying to suggest here that there are favorites, maybe. Because I've enjoyed all the conversations I've had. I've enjoyed most of the conversations I've had. Let me put it that way. Some more than others. So if I haven't mentioned you, don't take offense. These are just some of the ones that come to mind very easily. And I'll have a few more to add here in a little bit. When I began the podcast, one of the things that was very concerning to me was credibility. The spiritual world is full of people making really wild claims. And I am open to a lot of things. And I try to explore that openness. There have been a few people that I've invited on. And when I actually started reading their books, I'm like, oh, no, I cannot talk to this person. They are saying things that I am not giving them a platform for. There have been a few people that I've probably given platforms to that I probably should not have. But credibility was something that was important to me, and it's important as I move forward. So I've been saying that I'm going to be a little bit more discriminate about who I have on the show. I get emails a lot saying, hey, we have a potential guest for you. And so just as an example, I'm not going to name names, but I recently received one of these requests, and it's this woman who claims to be enlightened and has experienced, Brahma consciousness, unity consciousness, or something like that, and channels the life force or something, I don't know, and does energy healing. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't anything to energy healing. Maybe there is. I am always suspect of channeling. I've had a few people who claim to channel on the show, and I did have a conversation with John Friedlander about his book, I think it's called Recentering Seth, because I've always had this interest in Jane Roberts and the Seth material. So I was happy to talk to him. But typically if someone makes claims that they're channeling or, I'm very suspect, to put it mildly. I'm not saying that it's impossible, but I'm just a little skeptical. But this person, made these claims of being enlightened and channeling divine consciousness and doing energy work. And for $49 a month, you can subscribe to their website where you will get an unending amount of healing energy transmission. Nice work if you can get it. I call bullshit. I think that that's someone who's taking advantage of people. I can't imagine that anyone would like hand over $49 and say, yeah, send me all the good juju you've got and just take my money. It's a scam. It's snake oil, So I never responded. If they push it, I'm going to be like, no, 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 I'm not talking to you. So I am going to be a bit more discriminant moving forward. But again, I need to talk a little bit about that whole moving forward thing here in a moment. The episode that I think was the most important episode I did was with Alan Pierce, who was a former BBC correspondent. He and his wife, Beverly, wrote a book, A Coma and Near-Death Experience. And I think it's a great tragedy that that video only has 55 views. Because I think it was important. I think that his book was essentially important. The title is a little bit misfortunate. It's not the best title. Alan and his wife began this research during COVID when so many people would end up in the hospital on ventilators. And they would be placed into medically induced comas. And they begin the book with some of these people being brought out of this medically induced coma. And they would report these extraordinary experiences where they had completely other lives. And for them, that was their life. That was their reality. And then all of a sudden, they are yanked out. So they're actually experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder because it's kind of like, you know, in the Matrix, Neo made the choice to, you know, take the pill, right? But this is like just getting yanked out. Right, with no choice at all. So they began investigating. And this isn't about the experiences that people are having in comas per se, but it's more about people being placed in medically induced comas and being put on ventilators. Now, this hit home for me because that's how my dad died. It wasn't COVID. But my dad had an ongoing health issues, and he wasn't all that old. He was only, I think, 72 at the time. But he kept getting essentially congestive heart failure. His lungs would fill up with fluid, and he was constantly having to go, he would be in the hospital, and they'd treat him for pneumonia. He'd have to go in and get drained every week, and sometimes he would do it at home. So what they recommended was he had a pericardectomy, where the pericardium, you know, is the sac that the heart sits in. And his surgeon, they said it had calcified, so his heart couldn't beat properly. And because his heart couldn't beat properly, it couldn't get rid of those fluids. So they said, well, if we get rid of the pericardium, that will allow the heart to beat and you won't fill up with the fluids. So he made it through the surgery, it was fine. But they put him in intensive care, put him on a ventilator, and put him in a medically induced coma. Every time they would like try to pull him out and try to remove the ventilator, it didn't work. And so my dad never made it out of intensive care. Now, in Alan and his wife's book, what they say is that this is a faulty medical model because people don't need to be placed in these comas. They think that they do. If you've got this tube going down your throat, they think that people need to be in a coma state, and it's just not true. They report that, and there are a few people doing this, that, you know, you can sit up in bed with the ventilator. People would walk a little bit with the ventilators, and they would be eased off the ventilators. And they said that it actually gave people this hope and this knowledge that they're not going to be stuck. Right? That it's like, be on the ventilator forever or die, right? And that's kind of the choice my dad was faced with. And he chose death. So that one hit home. The other part that hit home is they also spoke about some of the drugs that are used in intensive care. And one of them was Prevent, I think, for anxieties. And my mom was sick the same time as my dad. She had stage 4 endometrial cancer, had a full hysterectomy. There were issues. My mom, there were issues not getting the rehab that she needed and not really being able to get on chemo because she didn't have insurance due to her not being honest about her age. But she was on Atrovent. And one of the things that happens is it can cause hallucinations. And what happened was my mom was in the hospital and she had what they were diagnosing as terminal delirium, where it's just, you know, the patient is nearing death and they're having these wild visions and they're just delirious. Mom was like that. I mean, she told my brother and sister-in-law to, you know, pick up curtains for the plantation. She, at one point, and this is always boggles my mind, she seemed to be trapped in this very like carnival-esque setting. And there was this darkness, this threatening male figure that was hiding by the whack-a-moles or something. But her oncologist came in and she just snapped to just like that. And he told her, he's like, yeah, you can probably go home in a day or two. And she never made it home. I had no choice. She was delirious. My brother had three kids, and so she couldn't be around them in that stage. She needed to be there. I certainly couldn't bring her back to California because all of her doctors were there. And in that situation, she needed, you know, those who were familiar with her case. So she had been in a rehab center and the rehab's like, nope, we're not taking her back. And so I had to make the choice to put her into hospice. And the day they put her into hospice, my mom went into a coma and never came back out, but they kept giving her Atrovent and morphine. And I remember asking the nurse, I'm like, you know, is my mom in a coma because of the morphine? And the nurse is like, no, we give other people the same amount of both of these drugs and they walk around. It was a brutal process, but I found out in the book that the Atrovent can create this, what is interpreted as terminal delirium. And maybe if my mom just wasn't given the Atrovent, that maybe she could have survived. She could have made better decisions for herself, better choices. Maybe she could have gone back into rehab, but I don't know. So anyway, that's personal, but it's one of the reasons why the book Coma and Near Death Experience has such a profound impact on me. And again, I think it's criminal that that video, me speaking with Alan, only has 55 views. I think it's probably the most important conversation I've had in 2 years, honestly. I want to mention some of the guests that I've had on that are no longer with us. So Stephen Harding, I had always wanted to talk to Stephen Harding. I had read his Animate Earth as a doctoral student. And then he came out with Gaia Alchemy. And again, there's that alchemical aspect. And I thoroughly enjoyed that conversation with him. He, as far as I know, he died rather suddenly and unexpectedly. Pierre Pratervand, I spoke to him about his book, The Gentle Art of Spiritual Discernment, I think it was. And when I spoke to Pierre, he was in a home. He'd been on oxygen, so he took the oxygen off. I think I may have been his last conversation. I'm not positive on that. But I found such a depth of wisdom in him, and he was such a calming presence. So it really made me, it saddened me. It wasn't unexpected, but it saddened me when I was informed that he had passed. And then Tamara Lucid. Tamara was an early guest on the podcast. We talked about her book, Making the Ordinary Extraordinary, My 7 Years in a Cult Los Angeles with Manly Palmer Hall. Now, Tamara is one of the guests that I've had on that preferred that I did not use the video. So I never actually saw her, even when we were recording. And I always give my guest that option. And I don't care. Truthfully, I don't care. I completely leave it up to them. I enjoyed the conversation with Tamara. I felt a bit of a connection. And Tamara did a lot of good stuff. You know, Tamara was, she was a riot girl, one of the founders of, or the founder of Lucid Nation. But she was in the background on a lot of things. She worked with some documentary filmmakers. I think she was a producer. Worked with some directors on a film on Standing Rock, which was actually an amazing documentary. And I spoke to her husband, Ronnie Pontiac, a few times. And whenever I spoke to Ronnie, I always felt that Tamara was there in the background. And I loved my conversations with Ronnie. And that's why I didn't mention him before, because I knew I would mention him now. We first spoke with his about his book, American Metaphysical Religion, which is an astonishing piece of scholarship. Ronnie's not, you know, academic scholar, but his book is a very excellent piece of scholarship. He and Tamara came out with a new translation of the Orphic Hymns, and then he was releasing a video series on YouTube, which is going to be a book, The Unobstructed Way, which is about Stuart Edward White and his wife Betty, not Golden Girl Betty White, but different. And Betty was something of a channel, and she died rather unexpectedly, but then he began getting communications from her. And according, if I remember right, Ronnie said that Carl Jung said that this case was the best evidence that Jung had ever seen for life after death. So Tamara passed away just a few months ago, very unexpectedly. And Ronnie has been, we're friends on social media, and he's been posting a lot. And my heart really broke for him, and I still feel this intense loss for him. But he is doing everything to keep Tamara's spirit alive. And he has, apparently a lot of people have claimed to have had experiences of Tamara after her passing. And so in the book that's coming out on The Unobstructed Way, I think it's like an afterword, he's going to be sharing some of these. So Tamara was a bright, bright, bright light. And as I had mentioned privately to Ronnie, you can't have a spirit that bright and just vanish. It's just impossible. So, you know, my heart goes out to Ronnie and to everyone that knew and loved Tamara, but also Stephen and Pierre. They're great losses. There may have been a few others that I may be missing or that I'm unaware of, but it's been a journey. So that's kind of where I've been. Right now, there are currently on YouTube 1,920 subscribers. So I'm pushing 2,000. This is after 4 years. The audio platforms, I've got 13 followers. This is not sustainable. I make a point of reading my guest books so that I can have an informed conversation with them. Now, some books are, you know, only 150 some pages, so that's fairly simple, but some books go up to 400 or more pages. Now, I know some podcasters will, it's not uncommon for publicists, to give like a list of questions. And some podcasters just kind of go down that list of questions. I have no desire to do that. I want to try to have an engaged conversation. My original thought was, well, I can rely on this background in journalism and my background in philosophy and religious studies and have good, meaningful conversations. And some people appreciate the work I've done. But I also know that most of the subscribers, not all, but most of them, follow the person who I'm talking to. So videos, it depends on how many views they get. I can tell you that people don't stick around for too long. Now, I fully admit to this. This is my fault. I haven't done enough in the way of shorts or taking little bits to create shorts. It's a job of work. I mean, reading a book, I can read about 30, 35 pages an hour. So if I've got a 300-page book, that's going to take me 8 to 10 hours to read. And then, you know, there's the scheduling of the interviews, the recording of the interviews, and then there is some editing that goes on. So I was putting in many, many hours every week, and I would try to get, you know, I'm like, go to my Patreon. There's only a handful of people that are on Patreon. I try to do ads on YouTube, but then inevitably someone's like, yeah, this was a good conversation, but there are way too many ads. I'm like, what do you want me to do? I've slowly been going through and removing the ads on YouTube and just having the videos for free because I get it. I mean, you know, what I would always tell people is, well, you can subscribe to YouTube Premium and creators get some money out of that, or sign up for my Patreon. But again, very few people want to do that. We're also used to getting things for free. But The fact of the matter is that this is just unsustainable. I can't continue to do this. I've watched my life savings just vanish before my eyes. And the podcast is, I love it. I love doing it. I love the conversations, but I had to make a change and I had to make some hard choices. So I wanted this to come out on, I guess it would have been the Friday the 5th, I think Friday, September 5th. I probably won't get posted until next Friday, the following Friday. When it gets posted, I'm going to be someplace else. I am going to be in London. I am moving to London. And let's see, September 12th, I should have known that, is when this will likely get posted. I'm making this move for a number of reasons. One is I did meet someone. I've been dating long distance, but he teaches secondary school in Enfield in North London. And shortly after we met, and this is before, you know, we started getting any kind of serious, but he knew my situation. He's like, well, you know, we have a teacher's crisis in the UK. And religious education is mandatory. Students have to take 4 years of it. So I'm like, okay, I'll look into it. I never wanted to teach middle school or high school. I'll be honest. I never wanted to do that. But the relationship started, you know, kept getting deeper and deeper. And I did more research and eventually connected with the UK Department of Education, their international recruitment office. I was assigned an advisor and I applied for some teacher training programs. And I was accepted into everyone that I interviewed with. But I ended up choosing the University of East London. And so I start September 15th. I'm going to get trained to teach religious education in the UK. I want to be able to utilize my education. I want to be able to teach. I belong in a classroom. I belong in a classroom. There are some challenges and it's scary as hell. I don't even know if I'm going to have enough money to support myself when it's all said and done. But I have faith that it'll all work out. It's not something that people my age would normally do. I'm going to be 58 here on Tuesday, on September 9th. But, you know, I don't have a house. I don't have a full-time job. I don't have kids. I want to try to make a better life for myself. That's what it all boils down to. I want to make a better life for myself. And it's incredibly important for me to be able to support myself, to not have to rely on the graces of my best friends, to live in their basements or anything like that. And I'm incredibly grateful for them. I can never repay what's been given to me, but I had to do something. So what's going to happen with the podcast? I have enough episodes that I've got enough episodes for the rest of the year. There's still a little bit of work that needs to be done on them, but I've got enough episodes for the rest of the year. I've got a few possible interviews that are coming up, but that's going to have to wait until I make it overseas. It'll be a little bit of a challenge. I don't know what my time constraints are going to be. I don't know how much time I'm going to have to read these books, and I don't know that I'm going to have 20 hours a week to devote to the podcast. I want to try to keep it going because I do enjoy this. I enjoy it quite a bit. But right now, I just don't know. I just don't know. I know I need to pivot because, you know, 4 years and I'm not even at 2,000 subscribers. And that's just, it's not sustainable. 13 subscribers on the audio platforms. And one of those is me. It's not sustainable. I tried to provide something that would be informative. I mean, the tagline I had for Rebel Spirit Radio was spiritual education for the rebellious soul. I don't think I'm too niche. I don't think it's too exclusive. I just don't know where the audience is. I've taken out some ads, but I don't have a lot of money, you know? So yeah, I want to do some different kinds of YouTube videos if I can. That's always been a goal of mine. We'll see. We'll see. I've got some things I do want to work on. I've got some that have been on the back burner for almost 2 years now. One on Stan Grof and another one on Ralph Metzner. I would like to finish those. I would like to do other educational videos on YouTube in terms of religion and spirituality. But like I said, in terms of the actual podcast and the interviews that I do, I'm going to be a bit more discriminate. And I don't know that I can maintain releasing an episode every week. It's too much. You know, it's too much. So I am also considering reopening. I have another YouTube channel, Hermit's Light, which is exclusive to tarot. So I may start posting there some more. I have a Substack, but I haven't really published at Substack. That's Substack at Rebel Spirit Radio. I would like to do that. I would like to do some more writing. And I also don't know the future of the Cocktail Apocalypse. That's a live stream that I do, or at least try to do once a month with my friends Stephanie Bidet and Jeremy Anderson. There's going to be a time difference. I still need to hear back from one of my friends as to whether or not an updated schedule. I can do Sunday evenings, which would be, you know, noon Sunday Mountain Time. But I'm not going to be able to do Saturdays at noon U.S. time, because that's going to be Saturday evenings in the U.K. And I already know I've got plans. So, yeah, that's where the podcast is, and that's where it's going. Again, I hope I can keep it moving forward, but I also have to act in a way that is in my own best interests. So that's what I'm doing. So I hope I can keep it going. I do. I hope I can keep it going. Again, thank you for my patrons who do help. And again, my Patreon is patreon.com/rebelspirit. You can also give a super thanks on YouTube if you would like. I can even take donations on PayPal if anyone wants to. If you find any kind of worth in what I've been doing here, and would just like to show just a little bit of love, I would be tremendously grateful. So yeah, that's about it. So thank you. Thank all of you for sticking with me over these past 200 episodes. I hope I get 200 more. I really do. I really do. But some things have got to change for that to happen. Some things have got to change for that to happen. So anyway, yeah, until next time, may you be at peace. May you flourish in all possible ways. And may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.